I remarked in my introduction that I would hold off saying too much until you had an opportunity to listen to this generation speak about their own situation in their own words. I want to end by sharing my own thoughts with you and by telling you what I've been thinking about during the process of working on this project. I have to say that I'm somewhat hesitant to try to sum up something so complex and multifaceted, or to give a singular viewpoint after hearing so many comments about how now is not a time for singular viewpoints. But I feel compelled to offer some interpretation of the situation, in part because I recognize that one of the things that our current moment lacks is the voice of the theorist or critic, and I would like to work to remedy that. At the outset of this issue, I stated that I was interested in this generation precisely because their work was explicitly not like the work being built by most architectural offices in the United States today. As the construction industry in the United States becomes ever more dominated by the logic of developer economics and becomes ever more risk-averse and litigious, and as the architecture that results from this situation appears to be ever more functionalist and normative, this generation's assertion that architecture is first and foremost a cultural enterprise makes their collective project critical. They have insisted that architecture is an art form, and that like music, film, fashion, literature, and the other arts, its progress involves experimentation with its own language, forms, processes, and qualities. They insist that the pursuit of such cultural progress is ultimately worth it, despite the fact that securing clients to support their work becomes more difficult as a result. As we have seen, everyone I interviewed chose careers in academia because academia grants them a freedom to experiment, and they did so knowing full well that building up a successful practice would become more difficult. I would say that their shared project is not only cultural and critical, but it is also disciplinary. We have seen in the episode on genealogy the degree to which everyone has inherited a disciplinary space produced in a particular set of schools in the United States. But we can also see their shared project as part of a disciplinary history, in the way that it criticizes two key disciplinary projects that were dominant from the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, namely the digital avant-garde and pragmatism. This generation has rejected the smooth, spline, and nerve-based curvilinearity that constituted the dominant aesthetic of advanced digital work a decade ago. And they have done so for ideological reasons, because they disagree with the claim made by the digital avant-garde that architecture's guiding value should be the demonstration of technical mastery. They also reject the digital project because it undervalued references and cultural meanings, and because the duck-like objects that avant-garde digital architects had been producing were simplifying architecture's cultural value, reducing it to iconicity alone. This generation also rejected the pragmatism that became dominant in the same years. They rejected the very idea of performance and the diagrammatic. The focus of the digital and pragmatist projects upon techniques and performance might have appeared at one time to have been a progressive step in the history of the discipline. This was because of the claim that an intelligence or professional expertise rooted in the material conditions of architecture would be best placed to enable architecture to change the world. Yet the emphasis upon technique and performance came to be seen as regressive by the late 2000s because it diminished architecture's claims to being a cultural artifact and because it diminished architecture's critical stance. This generation is thus ultimately embedded within this disciplinary history in the way that it reversed this situation and asserted the critical autonomy of architecture as a cultural enterprise through a much expanded array of formal experimentation. Yet with all this said, I also had some cause for concern, which lay behind why I asked so many questions about their relationship to theory, to ideology, and to the discipline. My concern was that while this generation is, in my view, disciplinary, their adoption of a single ideology of pluralism is impeding their ability to foster the progress of the discipline. This stalling of disciplinary progress will make it difficult for their work to become part of a lasting cultural history, and it will make it difficult for future generations to inherit the discipline from them. The cause of this failure seems to be rooted in a convergence of circumstances, including both their inheritance of some of the key intellectual claims of their teachers, and their acritical acceptance of the effect of big tech platforms on the means of disciplinary communication. In terms of the intellectual claims of their teachers, I'd like to highlight the importance of the discourse of affect, something I've recently written about at length in an article in Corain titled After Affect. From the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, affect discourse reasserted the power of the qualities of architectural surfaces, forms, textures, and colours to shape the feelings and emotions of users, and to do so without getting involved again in the critical, ideological, or semantic dimensions of those qualities. Affect theorists argued that, given the speed of information flows today, it's no longer possible to rationally judge what we perceive, such that vague feelings and emotions become more significant politically. Because of this, architects needed to learn to wield the language of vague feelings. In many ways, the arguments of the affect theorists anticipated very well the situation that occurred in the 2010s with the emergence of image-based platforms like Tumblr and Instagram, which came to play a central role in the way that architects shared work and communicated with one another. In short, the license to treat referentiality as little more than vague likeness became a condition of those platforms, which now governed the way that work was shared and circulated. While platforms such as Tumblr and Instagram enable their users to demonstrate a refined and educated taste through the construction of a signature taste profile, they limit communication to only the implicit, ambiguous, and laconic nature of images. They might have permitted individual cultural producers to bypass traditional gatekeepers and build large followings, but they've done so at the cost of barring the explicit, precise, and articulate nature of arguments needed to foster the discipline. And because the platforms privilege superficial forms of affinity and affiliation over fundamental differences, they bar discourse from having any ideological purchase. The platforms themselves have thus brought about a new superficial familiarity with a wider range of forms, but these forms have been shorn of a meaningful understanding of their historical context. This has enriched architecture's referential imaginary, but at the expense of that referential imaginary having any ideological substance. Over the last 5 to 10 years, this generation has also come to understand their project as being in the service of pluralism. This might at first glance be taken as an example of the stronger link between form and ideology that I am, in effect, calling for. Yet while pluralism is an ideology, it is only one ideology. I would argue that architecture needs a much wider ideological field to operate within in order to sustain its cultural progress in a democratic society. Narrowing its ideological field to the single hegemonic ideology of pluralism prevents the field from seeing ideology as a field, and thus from seeing ideology in operation at all. The everybody eats at the table inclusivism that this generation attempts to operate by does not serve to crystallize and make explicit the underlying political differences that are inevitable in any culture. This in turn fails to frame the negotiation and debate that must take place between competing political views in a democratic society. Another aspect of how pluralism dovetails with the traces of affect theory, in a way that is detrimental to the discipline, lays in the way it influences how this generation conceives of authorship. In place of singular authors, this generation has come to imagine that a collective is gathering around forms that are, as it were, developing on their own. This treats the buildings that everyone is designing as though they only speak to one another through the likenesses and similarity between their forms or their image, and it relieves any individual of the responsibility for saying what they intend politically and ideologically in the making of their work. In this post-authorial imaginary, the buildings that everyone is designing are no longer distinguished or positioned according to their intentions, attitudes, or meaning, and they are no longer grouped according to the larger ideological project that those buildings are advancing within an ideological field. Such things as rocks, stacks, ziggurats, profiles, and the various other commonalities recently put forth to understand the work are not projects in any ideological sense. There is no camp of rocks, no argument for stacks, no project of ziggurats. A project, I would go so far as saying, requires the articulation of a singular author's intent, a strong claim about what is new in the work, and how what is new reinterprets and critiques what has gone before. A project evokes a specific history and rewrites the meaning of its predecessors. A project links particular architectural forms and techniques to larger social and political claims about the way the world should be. Without projects, architecture will only endlessly mirror the flattened polyphony of algorithmically mediated images that the platforms impose. My argument here, ultimately, is that architecture must be understood as part of culture, and that culture must be understood as inextricably tied to politics, and that in a democratic society, politics must be understood as a debate and negotiation between different ideological positions. This generation has so far advanced architecture as cultural, but we could say that they've not yet advanced culture as political. Architecture advances one project at a time, and without a political conception of culture, architecture cannot have any projects and cannot advance. These are my thoughts for now about the predicament of this generation. They're still provisional. I'm sure I will change my mind on something by the time I get to putting down words in print. But for now, this is what I have to say. Thank you again for listening to issue 8 of Attention, talking about my generation. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and I hope that what you have learned has provoked some thoughts of your own about where architecture is and where it is going. It's much more harder. Way harder.